Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
The common good. What concerns Catholic voters in U.S. midterm elections? One crime doesn't justify another. The Vatican reacts to the death penalty for Saddam Hussein. And dowry dilemmas. Catholics speak out against disturbing trends in India. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Those are the stories we'll be looking at over the next half hour. Thanks for joining me. Perhaps more than ever before over the last decades, religion has come to play a major role in U.S. politics. In a recent national survey conducted by John Green of the University of Akron for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, most Americans said they want politicians to address issues of faith, but they are sharply divided over whether religious groups should be directly involved in politics. Well, whether they want to be part of government or just on the sidelines, religious groups across the faith spectrum have been very active over the last weeks and months, raising awareness among voters about the issues that concern them in the November 7th midterm elections. For Catholics, voting in the election is a moral duty. In their 2003 statement, Faithful Citizenship, a Catholic Call to Political Responsibility, the U.S. bishops wrote that responsible citizenship is a virtue and participating in the political process is an obligation. So, just how are Catholics expected to have voted in the elections for a new Congress and Senate in the U.S.? America's 65 million Catholics, some 30% of the voting population, have come to be seen as a critical swing vote in U.S. elections, though they too are divided into conservative and liberal camps. A number of Catholic activist groups launched pre-election campaigns to help inform Catholics about candidates' records and core issues of interest in this election. One of those groups is Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good. Spokeswoman Alexia Kelly told us the organization issued guidelines for Catholic voters because
we wanted to take a broader view, which is based on, for example, the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church that was issued by the Vatican, the Pontifical Office of Justice and Peace, 2 years ago. So many people in the United States don't know about the social doctrines of the Church in their fullness, and we really feel, we're dedicated to the vision of the common good, creating a culture of the common good and a culture of life in this country, and we feel that a vision of the common good as set forth in the social teachings, the encyclicals over the last century in particular, have set forth this vision, which is a very broad and deep vision of working together, of loving your neighbor as yourself, and not going it alone, and that this excessive individualism and materialism culture, which we sometimes have in this country, that is destructive towards the common good, and that really the root cause of abortion, for example, in this country, is this sense that we're not in it together, so that women feel very alone and don't feel that there's a welcoming culture of life in this country. So we wanted to step back and talk about what kind of culture, based on the Catholic social tradition, we need to create together to welcome life and to ensure the dignity of all, the poor, the weak, the vulnerable, of children, of everybody in this country.
So what can a Catholic do when confronted with a candidate who denounces abortion but supports the death penalty?
A Catholic citizen needs to look at all the issues, and I think our process described in our guide, Voting for the Common Good, suggests that Catholics need to inform their conscience. So study the Church's teachings, study the Catechism, study Faithful Citizenship, which is a document that the U.S. Catholic bishops create every 4 years here, and really look at what the candidates are saying, and then more importantly, their record. So what they've done in the past and what they're saying practically they're going to do in the future. So that's very important. That's our first step for Catholic voters to inform their conscience. The second is to exercise prudence, sort of moral common sense, as to how they can get the results that they want. And that's the sort of prudence is the what's required to sort out, well, if the candidate is they're pro-life and they're against abortion, but they're also for the death penalty, how am I going to make a decision here to get the best result? And then the third step is to vote in ways that most benefit the common good.
The Pew Forum survey conducted this summer suggested most Catholics feel the most urgent issues facing the U.S. today are poverty, economic justice, greed and materialism, and the war in Iraq. So how big an issue is the war in Iraq among U.S. Catholics, and how heavily are other issues likely to weigh on their vote?
Certainly the war is very much on the forefront of the debate and the discussion, and I think less so poverty and economic justice, but certainly perhaps a sense of insecurity, and there was a concern about Social Security people felt strongly that that should be preserved. And John Green has done a lot of studies at the University of Akron, and he's at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life here in Washington. And I think that some of the data shows, in fact, that Catholics are fairly united around, for example, when asked, and this is from traditionalist Catholics to what John Green calls modernist Catholics, there's a strong consensus, for example, around multilateralism and foreign policy for the U.S. role in the world, a strong consensus around government support for the poor, for example, taxes, or, government programs to aid the poor in this country. And also efforts to reduce the root causes of abortion. So I think, in fact, there's quite a consensus around a more common good vision of working together with other countries in a multilateral fashion on global issues. And as I said, also government role, working in it together to lift up the poor, for example, in our society.
Bishop Thomas Wenske of Orlando, Florida, would certainly agree. He's very concerned about U.S. immigration policy, another key issue in these elections.
Immigration certainly is one of the hot-button issues, but also the Iraq war is another very hot-button issue. Unfortunately, too many times we see an expression of popularism that seeks to exploit the fears of people. And a lot of the anti-immigration talk in the United States is just that, popularism that's exploiting the fears of people. And we as pastors are trying to appeal to their better angels and to tell them that we have to be in solidarity, and we have to tell the story about the immigrants, that they should not be demonized. And as Catholics, we can tell that story very effectively because we have helped resettle and integrate millions of immigrants into the United States, and our church has always been, in a very real sense, an immigrant church. And so, our history in the United States has been very closely tied with the influx of new peoples. When the United States was created a little over 200 years ago, there was only maybe 20,000 Catholics in the whole United States at that time, and one diocese was created very shortly after the independence of the United States, and 230 years later, we've certainly grown a lot, and that growth has been because of immigration. And oftentimes in the past, in the 19th century, for example, anti-immigrant feelings was just another way to mask anti-Catholic feelings. And so I think as Catholics, we should have a particular sensitivity to the plight of the immigrant and be their advocates as we contribute to this debate in public policy.
In October, the U.S. administration signed into law the building of a border fence, what some call a wall, between Mexico and the U.S. Understandably, in the run-up to the elections, many U.S. Latino Catholics, many from Mexico, were quite concerned about the new legislation. For his part, Bishop Wenske calls the new law inadequate and says he hopes a new post-election Congress will enact a more comprehensive immigration policy that respects human decency and dignity.
Right now, since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the world has seen a new impetus towards globalization. We see the free movement of goods across borders. We see that in NAFTA, for example, in the southwest border and on the northern border between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. We also see the free movement of capital, of money across borders, but we don't have yet the free movement of people. As in the United States, the labor market needs people, then the laws should be adapted to serve the common good. At the present time, these laws are, because they are inadequate and antiquated, they end up hurting the common good and hurting people. Positive law is always designed for the good of man, not for the harm of man. Even, you know, Jesus recognized that with divine positive law when he said that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. And so when laws no longer fulfill their purpose or they don't serve the common good, then they should be changed. And that's what the bishops of the United States have been saying in our participation in this debate for a broadly comprehensive immigration reform. Hopefully, when Congress comes back in the session after the elections, hopefully perhaps the fact that the wall has been signed into effect, maybe that makes it easier for voices of reason now to prevail and to convince the Congress to enact comprehensive legislation and not just be satisfied with this very inadequate law.
Bishop Thomas Wensky of Orlando, Florida there. And before, we heard Alexia Kelly from Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good. As Americans prepared to vote in midterm elections, an Iraqi court handed down the death sentence by hanging for Saddam Hussein. Vatican officials have condemned the death penalty, which they say is unjustifiable, even in the case of the former Iraqi leader and the terrible actions he committed. Cardinal Renato Martino, president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, says the death penalty should be internationally abolished.
You cannot punish a crime with another crime, because the death sentence is a crime, because although it's the state who discerns it, but the state is not the owner of the life of its citizens. Life is a gift from the moment of conception to the natural end of life, and so that sentence is not a natural end. I say that because John Paul II in Evangelium Vitae said, today society has all the means to render a criminal innocuous without applying the death sentence. In particular to the situation of Iraq, I don't think that it will make better the situation in that country. So this is what I think about this tremendous moment that Iraq is still living.
European governments are among those which have condemned the Iraqi court sentence. So could international pressure actually change the ruling in a court of appeals?
I don't know. Because we know that in order to enter to European Union, countries who apply for membership to European Union have to have abolished the death sentence. So this is important to know. And so I'm sorry to say that there are still many countries have abolished that. But there are still several countries who still apply that penalty, and they do not have yet chosen this choice of civilization, which the world is doing progressively.
President of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, Cardinal Renato Martino. A landmark law seeking to protect women from domestic violence has come into effect in India. The law also bans harassment over dowry demands. Although the practice of giving and taking a dowry is banned under Indian legislation, activists describe the law as ornamental and say it is almost never imposed. In recent years, as India has become more affluent, there has been a corresponding rise in extravagant dowry demands. This, in turn, has prompted an increasing number of the grooms' families to become dissatisfied with the dowry amount, and they begin harassing the bride in a bid to obtain more money or consumer goods. This harassment quite frequently degenerates into physical violence, and sometimes even leads to the death of the bride or newlywed wife. Susie Hodges tells us more.
Indian crime records say that one bride is killed or commits suicide every hour because of dowry disputes. Although dowries are banned in India, the practice is an integral part of the wedding process, and dowry harassment has become more and more common over the past decade. Many experts feel that the excessive burden of dowry payments nowadays is one of the main reasons why female feticide remains widespread in India. But why do dowries still exert such a pull in Indian society, despite the fact that they often become a crippling burden for the girl's family and can lead to so much harassment and suffering? Oswald Gracious is the Archbishop-elect of Bombay. He is in no doubt that although the tradition of the dowry originated as a voluntary gift, it has now evolved into an oppressive obligation.
I think it's been a tradition that when a girl gets married to a boy, the family gives something for her future. Now, the idea was that the parents wanted her to be taken care of and the husband would care. So it began in that sense like a gift. But gradually it has evolved in certain places as almost an oppressive obligation, which makes it difficult for girls to get married, which gives an opportunity for husbands to harass the girls if they don't bring the dowry. And so then the girl's life is made miserable.
Ignatius Gonzalez is a Catholic journalist from Kerala in southern India, who has studied the phenomenon of dowries. He says the law has totally failed to curb the practice, despite the threat of imprisonment.
There are very stringent laws, but still the practice of giving and receiving dowry is very, very prevalent.
And does it cut across all social strata and all religious groups?
It's almost universal now. Probably in the last 20 years, this has become a real serious problem. I should say even Christians, whatever be the denomination, Catholic or Orthodox or Protestant, the dowry system, it is an inbuilt practice.
But what would be a typical dowry demand in, say, an Indian middle-class family? Gonzalez describes just how lavish these dowry demands can be.
Let's talk about somebody reasonably educated, a graduate boy holding a university degree and working in the government service. Probably he will demand 50 sovereigns of gold ornaments and probably a medium-sized car and, of course, all the silk saris and other extra things. A medium-sized car will cost you in India, say, 300,000 rupees. One sovereign of gold is about 5,000 rupees. And he might even demand pocket money. for the honeymoon or whatever. It's called a pocket money. When you add up all these things, it is definitely a huge amount.
Archbishop Gracious feels that rising materialism throughout India is one of the main reasons why the husband and his family are becoming more and more grasping in their dowry demands.
So India is getting more affluent. There is more money to going around. Therefore, the demands, everybody wants to live better and wants to compete with the Joneses. And so not tens of thousands of, I would say hundreds of thousands of rupees they've begun asking for, and a car and a fridge and computer, things of this sort. Yes, that is spreading more, but that's because I think the standard of living has gone up. And as a result, as I said, it is becoming an oppressive obligation on the parents of girls, very oppressive obligation on parents of girls who have got to bring this for the wedding.
While Gonzalez agrees that rampant consumerism is definitely fueling this dowry fever, he says there are other factors at play in India, such as the traditional bias against women and the lack of a social security net.
I think there are three or four reasons, you know. One obvious reason is the spread of consumerist culture and the communication explosion, so to say. So everybody knows about the luxuries of life, which of course everybody can aspire to. And increasingly, the Indian people have become more and more consumeristic. That way, in marriage, you have a chance to demand these items like costly vehicles or household machines or whatever. This is a patriarchal society where boys are valued and desired more. And the parents invest heavily on boys. I mean, in India, education is a big investment. And in a place like Kerala, where I come from, the topmost priority of a parent is to give the best possible education to children. And boys, they are preferred. They get more money. The more investment is made on them. So this has to be somehow realized. Suppose I have a son, I have invested heavily on my son, so I must get it back in some way. And again, I would say, unlike the West, in India, we don't have the social security systems. So life is a challenge always, especially when you get married, you have to start a life. You need money.
Given the spiraling burden of these dowry demands, Archbishop Gracious says it's hardly surprising that many families of the bride struggle to meet their obligations.
What comes out in the press and the media, that they say, okay, they promised us a car and they did not give us a car, they gave us only a scooter. Or they promised us 100,000 rupees and they gave only 50,000 rupees. And then the girl is harassed to go tell your father to bring the remainder. And there are many cases of that sort. Quite prevalent, quite a number of cases. And those cases, I would say, are also, I've come across these cases even in the Catholic community, where the girl is harassed to tell your father to bring in the remainder of the dowry, and then, of course, then makes life very, very unpleasant for her. Those cases, yes, are on the rise.
As the dowry is generally paid in installments, Gonzalez says it's extremely common for the families of girls to contract huge debts whilst trying to fulfil their dowry obligations.
It's very, very common, very, very common. Most families, in my knowledge, to give a daughter in marriage will definitely land many parents up to the upper middle class level in debt. That is for sure.
So what is the Catholic Church doing to try to curb these excessive and violent dowry demands? Archbishop Gracious again.
What we've tried to do really is speak about the rights of women, that men and gender equality, try to sort of solve the problem at the very root, the mentality which is behind this. The woman is just a commodity and she's got to bring money and then she's taken care of, etc.
Presumably the burden of these dowry payments must be making many families feel that having a daughter is, in fact, a liability, and it must perhaps indirectly be fueling the practice of female feticide, which, of course, is a big problem in India.
You have hit the nail on the head. Exactly. That is the problem. Again, I would say that this is prevalent in the rural areas particularly, but also in the urban areas, that in the Christian community, it is not so much, the female feticide is not so prevalent. I know in some communities this is very prevalent, and precisely it is because of this, the dowry, the financial burden, the tremendous financial burden the parents have got to bear when the girl has got to get married. And so already as soon as she begins her schooling, the thought is, how are you going to get that money to get her married off? And the more money you have, the better the spouse you'll get. Sort of it's like if he's an engineer, it's much more. If he's a doctor, much more. In that sense, really, it is a problem. It is a burden on the parents.
Probably dowry is a direct contributory factor to this female feticide, because girls are becoming a liability, you know, unwanted for the family. Because if you invest money on her, if you educate her, if you feed her well or whatever, finally she has to go to somebody somewhere else in marriage, and you have to pay a very heavy dowry.
The tradition of arranged marriages in India also helps to explain why the practice of dowries has become so entrenched in society. Archbishop Gracious again.
Yes, it is so entrenched in society. Marriages are arranged by the families. They're not love marriages. And then the families negotiate exactly what will be brought and how she'll be maintained, etc. In the cities now, there are more and more cases of love marriages, but both of them say, no, we don't care for dowry. And so in that sense, in the cities, perhaps it will change gradually. But the arranged marriage system, which is a successful system in the sense that the marriages generally work out well because the parents look for a good choice, but then this has got this disadvantage that they also, when negotiating about alliance, they also negotiate about the dowry to be brought.
And it does seem that there's a lot of greed coming in here.
Yes, very often it's the in-laws. Assessing from the media, very often it's not the spouse who's greedy, it is the in-laws. Parents of the boy, sisters and brothers of the boy, force him to go and get more from the girl. That happens often. And then once it begins, then there is no end. And they ask for more and more and more. And then the girl is troubled, or the marriage breaks up.
But are many people rebelling against the practice of dowries, given the increasing financial burden they represent for any family with a girl? Archbishop Gracious says surprisingly few people do kick against the traces, because marriage is seen in India as a vital way of securing a girl's future.
The reason, I think, is because the parents are hoping, oh, the girl, we will ruin the girl's life if we make a noise, because the police would arrest the husband immediately. But then the girl, of course, has lost, her marriage is broken, she comes back home, and then there's another problem that the parents have. Holistically, the parents feel it's better to try to negotiate, compromise, try to take a loan and give the remainder of the money in the hope that the marriage will work. So really, not very many cases come to light. There are not very many cases where husbands have been arrested for this, although I'm sure there are many cases where the girls are suffering a great deal.
Gonzalez says although the dowry issue is sometimes seen purely as a gender problem, with women portrayed as the victim of men, it's not that clear-cut, as older women are often the strongest supporters of keeping up the dowry tradition.
In some way, even women, after a while, even if she experiences all these tortures and all that, and she suffers for the sake of the family, because family is a great value for India. So you better suffer and keep quiet, that is it. But when this very same woman, after years, when she has a son, and when he is married, she will definitely ask for a dowry. I mean, all the suffering she will repeat. So this is a vicious circle. It's going on like that.
That was journalist Ignatius Gonzalez, and you also heard Archbishop Oswald Gracious of Bombay. And I'm Susie Hodges. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.